Down to Business with Bobby Kerr on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Now, I told you about our business partner. They're like greyhounds in a trap here, ready to go. And I'm delighted to welcome in the form Gina London from the Language of Leadership and Robert Whelan of Rockwell Finance. Big celebrations in Carlo last week.
Absolutely, Bobby.
Robert,
Div 4 champions.
Yeah. So we couldn't let that unsaid.
Congratulations.
Now let's get down to business and let's look at the grim prospects that await us. We've got a campaign to cut energy use, which will promote carpooling and doing the laundry at night. Probably stuff we should be doing anyway, Robert.
Absolutely, yeah. You would have thought that there's obviously been a big push on sustainability, but I do... It's eerily... It seems to be like... It reminds me of COVID, where it was this thing... I remember January 2020, it was this thing that was happening a couple of thousand miles away. It wasn't going to affect us. And week by week, it was getting closer and closer. And I think we've just been... The government aren't starting the awareness of just that if this thing does blow up the way it blow, pardon the pun, but if this thing doesn't cease in the next couple of weeks, and no one seems to think it will, that we are facing into a pretty prolonged series of shocks to the economy.
Yeah.
And if we don't make some of these changes, we don't produce our own energy really outside of a bit of wind and solar. So I think, yeah, carpooling, they're looking at making sure you do the laundry at night, public transport. They seem to be very reticent, which is a good thing, about the full lockdown, work from home, because they're very conscious of particularly impacts on retail and hospitality.
Yeah, maybe put that to Gina. You know, working from home, we already work from home to a large degree, Gina, and the traffic congestion in Dublin is probably worse than it's ever been.
Well, look, the fuel prices continue, the oil prices are going up and the stock market continues to go down. And so the ongoing crisis in the Middle East is, I think, more than a ripple effect. Now we are looking at an oncoming tidal wave. And we're lucky that we're going into the summer in some respects, because heating fuel prices are going to go up. The cost of the pump, we've already got the barrel of an oil is about $115 at this point. Some reports are saying between $100 and $115. Over at the diesel, if you're trying to fill up your tank that way, it's $2.10 a liter. It's about $1.90, so 20 cents more over or less for petrol, but still a lot. And that's just the part of it. When you're thinking about what's going on for your travel, there was another story. I mean, the headlines are being dominated by the impact of Trump's war, as it's being rightly described. And one of the articles is Connor Pope, for example. He's talking about how many tourists aren't going to be traveling for summer vacation because the confidence and the uncertainty, the confidence is down, uncertainty is up. And so what that means is people from the United States who would obviously...
Yeah, and we're going to have a look at that in a minute.
Yeah.
The impact on, or the forecast impact on Irish tourism. But Conor Pope's piece, Gina, he talks about fuel. Conor Faulkner has said that if oil reaches $150 a barrel, basically, then the cost to Irish motorists will be $2.38 for diesel. Will end up going to $2.56, and petrol will be $2.74. Like, that's really
it's a significant
increase.
And a lot of the ripple effect too for people is coming out at, that they don't have certainty of what they're going to be able to plan for, where they're going to be able to go, then all these belt tightening measures become really, really a hardship. And when you're stuck in a big ivory tower called the White House and you're giving a speech earlier this week where you don't have any plan, it's clear for people who are trying to make projections, trying to make their own plans, that they don't know how to do that because there's no certainty on, oh, it might be 2 or 3 weeks or it might be this. It's really an unnerving time right now around the world. I've got clients that I should be serving. I was saying to Robert before we were coming in here, I was supposed to be in the UAE this week because the Department of Finance is a client. I can't get there because there's no guarantee with the flights that I'd be able to get in or I'd be able to get back. Same thing's happening to all those employees that are there who are international. Many of them, as we already talked about on this program and others, have chosen to come back, but some of them haven't because as you and I were saying, their visa to come back in is dependent upon their employment.
Yeah.
So how long can they afford to go out?
Like these are hard. These are live examples.
And these are everyday people who are being impacted by this impetuous decision that was made 5 weeks ago.
Just before we leave this, Robert, I see Owen Corrie saying there that a surcharge on fuel could be a possibility with air travel. So there was me thinking, booking my flights in June to the States, that maybe I might get in early before the price went up. But that is a possibility.
Absolutely.
That if the fuel prices keep rising, that the airlines will be forced into a fuel surcharge, which wouldn't if you had an existing booking, you wouldn't escape that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is, it's a real life prospect. I think it's because a lot of airlines nearly went bust after COVID. So they're looking at that. I think it was the chair of, or CEO of United issued a piece to every employee about 3 or 4 weeks ago in advance of this, when this erupted, basically saying, we're sufficiently resourced, we're going to work our way through this together. But at the end of the day, if the cost of jet fuel increases at the way, and the more importantly, the scarcity, I think this is what people, it's not just the cost, it's the scarcity factor we need to worry about.
Available supply.
Available supply is huge. And when you see Michael O'Leary coming out, normally Michael O'Leary's in the media book, I need more slots, I need more flights. And he's saying we have to cut schedules by 5, 10, maybe 15% to react to this. That just tells you it's real.
Yeah.
And these are the guys who are at the coalface. They're getting the real information. It's not sanitized. This is where it's going to be. I think people need to be prepared for that. And I think the fact that the airlines can add that cost to it, just to be prepared for your budget. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Now, we've seen it with fuel, where the price at the pump is slightly different to what's happening on the wholesale market. We're seeing the same with Easter eggs.
Yes.
But the other way around. Easter eggs stay pricey, even as cocoa falls.
Well, happy Easter almost to everybody out there. Hope you've already bought your Easter egg. But if you haven't, it's apparently going to still be about 12% more in the U.S. and 9% more in the U.K., despite what this report is saying, that there's been a fall in price of cocoa. And they're over the crop has been better up in West Africa where they're grown.
The price 70% of cocoa is down.
70% down, but 12% up. So is it price gouging because it's the time to buy these wonderful chocolate Easter eggs? Or, as this article says, some of the suppliers are saying, is it a supply chain price lag that they just haven't caught up? But apparently, if it's been 70% down since 2024, as this article says, and here we are in 2026, that is one hell of a lag.
Robert, let me remind you that a Galaxy Easter egg
here we go.
Has more than doubled per 100 grams since 2023. That's only a very short time ago.
3 years.
And a Cadbury's cream egg is 81% more expensive over the same period.
It's and probably 25% smaller.
Shrinkflation.
Well,
we even get into
like, I remember getting, my granny used to give me a Yorkie when I popped to see her on a Sunday. And you'd nearly live off the thing for a week. It was this giant bar. And today it's the size of a Club Milk. So definitely everything's getting more expensive and things are getting smaller.
Gina, you mentioned there the real impact, financial impact, you know, that businesses like your own are having. There is this piece, we talked about it, Senan Maloney's piece, is rather stoic and grim. Ireland faces major tourism hit as Trump's war means Americans won't travel abroad.
Yeah.
And we need to remind listeners that 30% of all our tourists here are Americans.
Exactly. And so people coming from North America, as you said, Bobby, make up 30% of all the tourists coming into Ireland. And the other statistic around that that's important that this article that Senan points out is that they usually spend a lot, substantially more than their British counterparts, for example, when they're here. And yet, as I was saying, the confidence right now of the people abroad is low. They're trying to think about their own situations at home, let alone booking their vacations, as we would say in the U.S., or their holidays for the summer. And so they're unlikely, less likely. And that means a real concern about for the hospitality industry, for the economy in general, what's going to happen if this war, as it we're expected, we're moving into the holiday season right now. And so what's going to happen? And this is one of these under, there's so many things, different sectors that are being impacted. This article puts out the point that, look, it's about to really kick in. There's budget allocations, there's job concerns, there's cost of living crisis. And so that's going to be something that translates into a luxury item like a holiday.
Robert, we looked at the 9% VAT rate and the impact of it. But as Senator Maloney says, 9% of nothing is nothing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think when Pascal was doing his maths, he was working on the basis that we would still obviously have potentially increased numbers of tourists, and I may make up for it. So it is real. And I do think it is important that particularly, like the Senate highlights that 25% from the UK, but 30% from North America, it's the spending is really important, particularly in hospitality.
Yeah.
Because they tend to order the more expensive drink. They'll do a lot of golfing. So they don't come and live on a budget lifestyle. They tend to come and spend a lot, disproportionate amount of money. And again, for an industry that's got its own issues, it's certainly not welcome.
Dublin's derelict property owners face a crackdown. It's on the front page of the Irish Times.
This is brilliant.
It is actually, because what we're seeing here is a kind of a shift where finally the council have said, we're going to do something about this. I think the most noted change is that the derelict property tax is now going to be collected by revenue. That's significant because that means it'll be collected.
This is a great story. I'm frankly, anecdotally, since I've moved here, I came from Baltimore, Maryland at one point in my life in the U.S. where they had an extreme, they still have an extreme abandoned housing situation in that city. And I was thinking about all the incentivizing that Baltimore did to try to fast track foreclosures and acquire abandoned properties and to try to really incentivize investment in whole blocks and not just scattershot. And so when you look at what's happening here, this article that is talking about these new plans, as you mentioned, from this Dublin City Council to do an entire map of the whole area so they can see it from a broader perspective, also to, as it said in the editorial that accompanies this article in the Irish Times, to actually designate particular neighborhoods for development. That's a really holistic approach to it. To have, as you said, and in the revenue, the levies be collected by revenue instead of local authorities, and to create an entire company, the Dublin City Development Corporation, will now have a mandate to deliver housing and to convert these derelict buildings into cost rental apartments. And I thought, too, the idea of being able to borrow money or buy sites or engage in joint ventures, getting more private-public partnerships to come in.
It gives them an awful lot more scope.
It does seem to be much more of a holistic approach,
absolutely,
which is long overdue.
You had Richard Shakespeare in the executive chair not so long ago.
I did.
And this is just another sign. He's doing great work, let's be honest. He's doing very good work. And I think the idea to create the SPV along the same lines of Ballymun Regeneration. In terms of budget, it's great. They're saying they're giving 18 million. They're going to get an additional 10 from the state, potentially an additional 115 from the state. But the mandate is that it's going to be sustainable. So they're going to be choosing which sites that they'll sell and which sites they'll develop.
I think it's also interesting, Robert, that they've picked Middle Abbey Street, North Frederick Street, two streets that definitely need this.
Yeah,
and we'll be able to judge very quickly if this is working or if it's not.
But again, it's so, to be fair, and again, I'm not someone who's the biggest fans of how's the public sector, but it's great to see that this is, what would any commercial business do? You'd put the test case, see if it works, and then you'd invest into it. So it's great to see. And from my perspective, I'm going to give a shout out. There's a guy called Rob Cross on Twitter. He's an architect. He's been doing tremendous work on this whole area of dereliction for the last 4 years, just showing us all the different sites and all the different potential. And I do think Dublin badly needs life in the city, living in the city. It will make a difference to tourism.
Absolutely. A business story, Gina, Russian-owned Achnish Alumina. Their plant in Limerick, I know it's one we don't even think about. It's Russian-owned. They recorded profits of 103 million. Their revenue up 50%.
Okay, but headline here for me. This was a jaw dropper for me because I didn't know that there was a Limerick company that was owned
doing
aluminium or aluminum, depending on how you say it. that was Russian owned and, according to the Irish Times, has been shipping big amounts of alumina to the smelters in Russia, where it is used to make aluminum for that company that then translates it into Russian arms manufacturers. So apparently Limerick is supporting Russia against Ukraine and reaping record profits.
Well, I don't know if that's quite...
I don't think I'm making a stretch, because this very same article then goes and says that Michal Martin is concerned about the reports that these raw materials are ultimately, in the words of the article, supplying the Russian war effort. Now, because we are fair journalists here, it does have a response from the alumina companies, the how do you say this company?
Anish.
That's
Anish Alumina.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah.
So the Limerick company then says that it does operate in, quote, strict compliance with all applicable European Union laws, and that also does say deeper down into the article that it has not been put under any sanctions by the UK, EU, or the US. But yet it does certainly indicate that their supply chain does go right into Russia and does ultimately become weapons.
A 50% increase in sales.
Yeah, because supply and demand. There's a big demand.
It's an interesting company. It's very checkered history. It's been in Limerick a long, long time.
A long time. I remember growing up hearing about Anish Alumina.
Robert, let me ask you about this, because I know is your space.
Absolutely.
The son of SSIA, born into a world far different than the Celtic Tiger. Mick Clifford is writing this in the Irish Examiner today. He analyses the old scheme where for every €4 you saved, the government gave €1. This is back in the Charlie McCreevy days, versus what's now being proposed by Simon Harris, which is a Swedish model, not as generous as the one that we had in the... But nevertheless... one could save tax at least.
Absolutely.
What do you think about this scheme, and what do you think of it versus the old scheme?
Well, nothing will ever top the SSIA, but it was a fabulous piece. It was like reeling in the years. He talks about Eddie Hobbs running down the street to the backdrop of Born Slippy. I suppose, listen, from my perspective, anything that encourages Irish people, Simon Harris seems to be obsessed with this for some reason, right? So the SSIA was, you put your money, the government, a minimum of 1250 to a maximum of €250, and you got a top up of 25%, and you could put it into a deposit account or you could put it into an investment account. It was a 5-year period, and that was it. This, what Harris is looking at doing now, is looking at encouraging Irish people to take their money. That there's 170 billion famously sitting on deposit in Ireland, and he's trying to get Irish people to take the jump to invest. And he's quite rightly identified that a barrier has been the tax. So at the moment, Bobby, if you invest in an ETF or in an insurance company type of fund, you take 62% of the gain, but 100% of the risk.
Yeah.
The tax is 38%, and you've no way of offsetting it. It's not like capital gains tax where you can do an offset. So they're looking at going, the state are getting 0% risk, 38% of the gain. So he's looking at reducing that. In my opinion, the option he's looking at, the ISK model in Sweden, I believe is too complicated, if I'm honest. You should look at the ISA from the UK. It's simple, it's tax-free.
Simplicity in this area is definitely your friend.
Yes.
Now I have to declare an interest in this next piece because I'm actually a contributor to the article. How much does it really cost to open a coffee shop? Gina, a lot of esteemed expert analysis in here, but what did you make of this piece?
Well,
it's not as good as it seems. Sure, it's not.
You know, look, it's an article in the Irish Independent on the money article
by Geraldine Herbert.
By Geraldine Herbert. And as I'm sitting here sipping my €4 Americano, the thrust of the article, which is it's a profile of a number of different coffee shop owners, including your fine self, which does list you as the former insomnia chief. Your quote of saying that cash is king and it's very easy to underestimate the cash flow needs of a new business is, I think, the headline for this whole story for any small business owner that is thinking about the idea of having a beautiful coffee shop in this small, wonderful, cozy, atmospheric place, but the reality of what it takes to the expenses, what it takes to turn it over, how difficult it is, unexpected costs. This whole article goes through and profiles a number of people. And it's a good story, not just from a coffee shop perspective, but from small business owners anywhere about the grit, the graft, the planning.
Well, that's it.
And like, ultimately, the question is it worth it? And I think that one of the takeaways here is that it's not easy, and it is really, it could be profitable, but that only happens if there's a clear understanding of the costs, the pricing, and the operations. Quote, otherwise, the dream can become a nightmare. And it's a cautionary tale.
Robert's loving coffee is not a business plan.
Absolutely not that line.
Passion isn't your friend.
It absolutely isn't.
To opening a shop.
And listen, Bobby, as you know yourself, like, it is an incredibly...
God, do I know.
It's an incredibly tight margin business. And you look, and I do think people do underestimate the costs. And like, you're seeing like hopefully 8 to 12% margin. But then looking at costs here, so some shops in Dublin, they're looking at 5% margin.
Yeah.
That's incredibly tight.
That's on a good day.
And one anecdote I'll share with you is part of my conversation sometimes with clients, I'd say, if money was no object, what would you do? So what do you mean? Money was no object. You didn't need to, just money was no object. What would you do? I swear in my life, 40% of my clients who are high-flying execs and, you know, big multinationals, open a coffee shop.
My God.
And I'd say, are you crazy? Why? They think it's all socialist.
The romance versus the reality.
I'd say, you're crazy.
Get in there for a week and you'll change your mind.
Absolutely.
All right, finally then, Michael O'Leary. EU is punishing the Brit travellers for Brexit. He says this clearly with his tongue in his cheek, Gina. When you stroll past a group of English people at a passport queue and you wave your Irish passport at them saying, God, didn't you guys make a big mistake?
Well,
they don't really like it.
Well, listen, the ever demure Michael O'Leary, who's very quiet and soft spoken, is out complaining about how the prediction for this summer, assuming we do have tourists that are willing to travel and get on planes, that if you don't have an EU passport, that you're going to be upwards waiting for 4 hours in a line. Is really, that's not good for anyone thinking about that. And he says, well, it's punishment for Brexit. But hey, as someone who used to have to wait in that EU line, because an American passport is just as bad as a British passport, and we didn't vote for Brexit. We voted for the other guy that's wreaking havoc, but that's another story. But the article here, though, that I liked is that, you know, thankfully now for me, I have the Irish passport,
and
I can wave it and laugh at it.
Last word to you, Robert.
Absolutely, yeah, he's right. It is. This is what they have done. They don't want, for instance, they don't encourage other states to think that leaving the EU is a good idea. So, showing the retail voter, this is potentially what's ahead of you just for simple travel. But ultimately, he's lying here. Here you voted for exit, effing join the queue. It's classic Michael O'Leary.
All right, on that note, we need it. Happy Easter to you both, Gina London and Robert Whelan. Thanks for joining us here this morning. And as I say, enjoy your Easter.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 8. News Talk. Conversation that counts.